Welcome in. Halfway through the work week here from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Another episode of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Tony Donahue with you, with the historian of the IMS Museum and all things Indianapolis 500. Donald Davidson is with us. Donald, good evening to you.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
Good. Did you have a good day today out here?
I did. I had a very good day.
The weather was excellent. A lot of things going on. A couple accidents as well. And I got the chance to tape a little baseball video along the bricks, too. So I'm trying to make a little history out there, right? Well, you can call in 239-1070, 317-239-1070, or send your questions on Twitter at TonyD1070. And Donald, without further ado, let's go to our first caller of the night. We'll head up to Muncie, Indiana, and Sarah. Sarah, you're on the program with Donald Davidson.
Hello, Sarah. Hello.
Hi. Hi, guys.
Hello.
What do you got?
Hi. I had a question for you. Did Bruce McLaren actually run at Indy? I know his team had cars, but did he actually run at the Speedway?
He drove in practice, but he never made a qualifying attempt. In 1968, there was a team, three cars with two drivers. They were Turbans. And the drivers were Dennis Holm and Bruce McLaren, and they did not perform up to expectations, and apparently there was a technical issue where it was discovered that they were trying to find a way around the regulations. And so anyway, the cars were withdrawn early in the month. I think on May the 8th of 1968, they were withdrawn. Dennis Holm ended up driving for Dan Gurney, but Bruce McLaren elected to not try to drive another car. So those were the practice laps that he ran in 68 with the intention of making a qualifying attempt, which he did not do. 2 years later, when Team McLaren entered for the first time, the drivers were Dennis Holm and Chris Amon, and the third car was assigned to A.N. Other. And I was working for USAC at the time, and there was much confusion about who A.N. Other was and that he would have to fill out an application and take a rookie test. I said, no, it's a British thing. If you're not sure who the driver's going to be, you put another, but A.N., A period, N period, other. And, oh, I didn't know that, so all right. But Bruce McLaren did drive the cars briefly in practice, but he never intended to make a qualifying attempt. They were just simply exploratory runs to just feel the handling and everything like that. And so those were the only 2 years that he was on the track. He actually, in the spring of 67, they had a private testing session. But anyway, the answer is he never tried to qualify for the 500. And then after the 1970 500, just, 3 days later or something like that, on June the 2nd, he was fatally injured testing a Can-Am car at Goodwood in the south of England.
Thanks so much for the call, being the first call tonight. Sarah, calling again with your question. Let's go up to Toledo. Jason wants to talk Sid Collins. Jason, you're on the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson.
Hello, Jason. We were up in Toledo, two, 3 weeks ago, I think.
Yes, sir. I saw you there.
Oh, okay. What would you like to talk about?
Well, in recent years, I have become more and more into the old radio broadcast of the race, and I was wondering if you could talk about Sid Collins tonight.
Well, golly, where would I start with that one? Sid was hugely important in my life, and I owe him a great deal of credit for what I was able to do with the greater part of my adult life. And he was exceedingly helpful for me, and took me under his arm from about the time I showed up here, and was exceedingly helpful in my first year, and always very encouraging. And then when I came back to live, he put me on the radio network. I'd been a guest by my first year, and he was always exceptionally kind to me. And the fact that I was living here year-round, we'd have dinner from time to time. And in fact, when I had just got married at the point where I had to go away and do basic training, because although I was an English citizen, and I didn't know that Will Power was an American citizen until just today. I didn't know Tracy was as well. I learned that on Trackside tonight. But anyway, when I came to the country permanently, I had to register with the local draft board, and so that required that I was going to have to do something, and I joined the National Guard. And then in January of 67, I went away to do my basic training. And the night before I went away, Sid Collins took my young bride and I to dinner. Professionally, Sid was, he's from Indianapolis. He went to Shortridge High School. In fact, there's a little bit of trivia. He worked on the Daily Echo, which was the Shortridge had a newspaper put out by the students, and it was Monday through Friday, and they had a different staff for every day. And one of his, I don't know if he was actually a classmate, but in the same year with him, and in a group shot that I have hidden away somewhere, Kurt Vonnegut was also on the Daily Echo. Anyway, Sid went to IU, and he served in World War II overseas in Britain. And then when he came back from the war, he got into broadcasting, and his first job was at... KMO in Kokomo. I may have the call letters wrong, but anyway, he was up in Kokomo for about 6 months, and then there was an opportunity at the then fairly new WIBC, and so he came back down.
I've heard of that.
And in 1948, he was on the radio network, except that it wasn't the Indianapolis Motor Speedway radio network yet. It was the old Mutual Broadcasting network. And so Sid was assigned to the South End. In those days, they didn't have an announcer in each corner. They had people in the pits and in the booth. And then they had somebody at the north end to watch 3 and 4, and then down in turn 1 to do 1 and 2. And Sid had that gig. And the Mutual broadcast would do, I think, 30 minutes at the start of the race. They'd do like 15 minutes prior to the start, and then through to about 15 minutes into the race, and then they would leave the air and come back for updates and then return for the finish and then try to get the winner in victory lane and so on and so forth. And on one of the segments, they'd just gone on the air when Sid called for a yellow because Dwayne Carter had lost a wheel. Just, I don't know if the axle broke or what, but the wheel came flying off, and Dwayne had to spin around and did a masterful job of not hitting anything. And Sid used up about the whole 5 minutes doing the description of that. He was on the network again in 1949. In 1950, there was a man named Bill Slater who came from New York. And everybody else was a WIBC employee. I think everybody else on the air. And so Bill Slater would come in like the night before the race and just study up and then be the host for the event. Well, in 1950, he'd had an illness, and there was some thinking that he may not come. And so Sid got the go-ahead that he was going to be the anchor. And then at the last minute, Bill Slater showed up, and he could tell that Sid was very, very crestfallen, and he was rather a fatherly-type character. And he said to Sid, "Look, son, why don't you come in and we'll work this together," which was really nice of him to do. And so they co-anchored, but again with that 30 minutes of start, 30 minutes of the finish, and then just updates throughout the race. However, Sid went down to do the winner's interview, and the race was rain-shortened, and Johnny Parsons, senior, pulled into victory lane, and Sid did the interview there. This is probably more broadcast history than you wanted, but I just happen to be...
I love it.
...familiar with this subject. So in 1951, Mutual Radio Network That their major sponsor was Perfect Circle Piston Rings from Hagerstown. And for 1951, they hiked their rates considerably. And Perfect Circle said, that's too rich for us, sorry. And so they went through the spring, and they couldn't get a sponsor. And so it appeared that there wasn't going to be any radio for Mutual. And what happened was, at the last minute, the WIBC people said, well, you know what? We supply everything. We do all of the technical help, and we do everything except for the host. So why don't we just do it anyway? And so they did the broadcast, and Mutual picked it up. And so they already had an idea in mind, and still with the old format. And Sid was the anchor, and they went down and did the winner's interview with Lee Wallard. So during the winter, then they went to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway management. Now, in those days, WIBC's offices were downtown, and I don't remember exactly where, but I think like Washington and Meridian or something. I was just right downtown.
Sounds right.
And then the Speedway offices were not out here. They were at 444 North Capitol. And so it was like four blocks or something like that. So the WIBC people, headed up by the sales manager was Gil Berry, who was from Illinois. He'd been a famous football player. And so anyway, he and Sid and a couple of the others went to meet with Wilbur Shaw and Tony Homan and proposed the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network. They said, great. And so in 1952, the network was launched. But it's been reported in a lot of different areas, which turns out to be not true, that they did the broadcast in its entirety. They did not. They did the old Mutual format. However, when they did that, there were only four other radio stations in town, and they all showed their displeasure because they had wanted to do something similar and figured that they had just been given a slide job for a WIBC. So Wilbur Shaw and Tony Homan, wanting to appease everybody, they rethought it and then expanded the radio network so that all of the local stations would be involved. And they did the broadcast in its entirety from, I think, maybe 30 minutes before the start, all the way through, only left for commercials, and then obviously the wrap-up and the winners and so on and so forth. And so history was made because of the five stations. Each station had a representative of the other four rivals on it. And they had, you know, well, I could give you the rundown on the personnel, but all the stations were represented. Anyway, Sid was the anchor. And the first year in 52, they had 26 stations. And by 53, if they didn't have 100, they were awfully close. And radio was just king in those days. And Sid, as the anchor, they didn't really do play-by-play because the race was very much of an enduro then. The winners were getting by on just a couple of pit stops, and yellows had to be something pretty major. So there were great lengths of time when there wasn't a whole lot going on. And so what he did, it was like a party with a race going on in the background. And so he would have guest celebrities, and then he would solicit mail from people, tell us where you're hearing us. And they got all these stories about people listening to them in I don't know if anybody was listening in an igloo, but they got some really weird responses. But most importantly, the American forces overseas. And they had all of these letters coming in from the parents plus the soldiers themselves. Just so nostalgic because maybe they weren't having the best of day wherever they were stationed in a foreign country, but they heard the race on the radio, and it just made them so nostalgic. And so Sid became very much of a star, and he did play-by-play. He did other sports, but to me, Sid at his best was an MC of a banquet. He was just an outstanding master of ceremonies. And he did commercials, and he modeled, and he never married, and he was very much of a man about town. and great ideas. I mean, he was under contract for several companies, and he was amazing ideas. And then one of the things for which he's most probably well known, or a lot of people it comes to mind, was not only whenever he had to do a eulogy, and how eloquent the eulogy was and heartfelt, but then also the closing thought. And he read a lot. He read biographies, autobiographies, not racing, but just showbiz. He liked biographies or autobiographies of people that had become a success. And when he would see these quotes, it might be October or March or whatever, and he'd read and say, that would be great for the broadcast. So he was constantly studying. He was witty, told jokes, it sort of transcended being a sports announcer, because around town for a number of years, I mean, he was one of the best known people in town. I mean, he was right up there with the mayor and the governor, you know, was local. Yeah. And everything. Just Sid was when you'd say, well, name people from Indiana, Sid would be one of the first people that you could think of. So I don't know really whether I did him justice here, because it's more of the history of the broadcast. But I mean, Sid was the broadcast, and the number of people still to this day talk about their traditions that they either came to the race and brought a radio with them, and apparently a lot of people still do that. Mm-hmm. Bless them.
Yep.
And because they say we can get more off the radio than because the effort for years has been to get everybody out of the race if you can get them. And I'll just come back and some more Sid thoughts was that, and I was in on some of these meetings early on when he would talk to the fellows and say, now remember, we are describing for this to people who do not see it. And there were a lot of people who were without sight that appreciated these descriptions. And he said, now we're looking at it. They are not. So we tell them what we're seeing. And it's not just about who's running where, but let's throw some color in it. And if there's somebody in the grandstands that's got a multicolored umbrella, let's tell them about that. And he said, if the helmet's yellow on the driver, tell them that. If the car is red, tell them that. Mm-hmm. And if you know specifically it's candy apple red, tell them that. And I'll wind up with this, which probably came down from Sid, was a lady I've actually known for quite some time and haven't talked to her quite a while. And she was the daughter of Rita Collette, who was the editor of one of the Dayton, Ohio papers. And I don't remember if it was the Dayton Daily News, but anyway. So he came over to the museum one day, and this is probably 78 or 79, or maybe even 77. And so I met him over there, and I think she was probably about 15 or 16 at the time, but had no sight at all. And I wasn't working for the museum. I was still at USAC. But we went over, and the host said, would you like to go behind the ropes? And it was Janet Guthrie's, the car that she took a rookie test in. And so we helped her, this young lady in. And she felt the car, and she felt the cockpit area. And she was a big race fan. And she said, and I'll never forget this, she said, oh, so that's what these things look like. I never forgot that. And when I, in my humble offerings on the radio network, when I'm trying to describe something, I'm thinking about those people that cannot see what you're talking about. And that I learned that from Sid. And I know I went on a little bit here, but I can't thank him enough, because from the time I showed up, within minutes, he was already, taking me under his arm and helping me. So thank you, Sid Collins.
Thanks for the call, Jason. What a great story there on Sid Collins. And just to echo your points, Donald, there's nothing better than listening to, especially the Indy 500, but any IndyCar event on the IndyCar Radio Network. The term to me, art in motion, comes to mind because, I'll be in my car driving, and I always try to, watch the race as much as possible, but also try to listen to it. And there is just no better sporting event than the Indianapolis 500 to be heard on the radio. It's fun to see the cars, but listening on the radio, especially while you're inside the grounds, just brings everything to life. You're always up to date on what's going on. And from the turn reporters to the pit reporters, it is always just the best broadcast that if you haven't heard it and you're a racing fan, you certainly have to check it out.
Well, it's a thrill for me to be a part of it, and I never take it for granted. And in fact, for the last several years, at some point I have said on race day, thank you, Sid Collins.
Absolutely. More to come on the Talk of Gasoline Alley right here on FM 107.5 and 1070. The Fan, 239-1070, 317-239-1070 is the number. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Welcome back live to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Tony Donahue with the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Museum, Donald Davidson, on a fast Wednesday here from IMS as the sun sets over the bleachers here on the front straightaway. We will continue on. And Trevor is over in Claremont. He did not get in last night, so we'll get him in here to start segment two. Trevor, go ahead. You're on with Donald Davidson.
Hi, how's it going, guys?
Fine, Trevor.
I had a quick question about Jim Gilmore and kind of how he got connected with A.J. Foyt in the early 1970s. And then kind of the second part of the question, very long shot, has there ever been any heritage traced between Jim Gilmore and the Gilmore Oil family of the Gilmore Specials in the 1930s?
All right. To the best of my knowledge, no connection whatsoever. That was Earl Gilmore from California. Jim Gilmore is from Michigan. To the best of my knowledge, not even distantly related. How Jim Gilmore got involved was in 1967 with Gordon Johncock, when the so-called tire wars were going on between Firestone and Goodyear. There were several drivers that were set up with their own team, Gordon Johncock being one. In reality, Gordon Johncock was not a car owner. He was fronting for a Goodyear-backed effort because they didn't want it to be out there that Firestone and Goodyear owned all the cars, which they practically did for the year there. Anyway, so there was the Johncock racing team, and Gordon Johncock qualified for the outside of the front row and as the just Johncock racing team special. And then after qualifying, Jim Gilmore appeared, and the car ran in the race as the Gilmore Broadcasting Special. So he did it with Johncock, and then with it was on Art Pollard's car in 71. I'm trying to think the first year that Gilmore, I hadn't thought about this for a while. The first time that Foyt carried the Gilmore sponsorship in 1970, Gilmore was on Jack Brabham's car, and then in 71 it was Art Pollard, and then 72 he was with Lindsey Hopkins. So 73 was the first year that that Gilmore got on with A.J. Foyt, and then that was a run that went all the way up through till well, when Skoll came into the picture. I'm not very good on the recent sponsorships, and to me, mid and late 80s is recent. But anyway, he was associated with Foyt for many years there, and was actually he had a PR man who was wondering whether the relationship between Foyt and Gilmore was a record, and I said, no, unfortunately, Richard Petty and STP Corporation are ahead of you a little bit, and it was put out at one time that STP had a lifetime sponsorship agreement with Richard Petty, so I said, you're going to have to wait for that to end and then come back and do two more to beat him. But yes, I've been asked that a number of times, and the assumption is that there would be a connection between Jim Gilmore and then the Gilmore Oil Company and the various Gilmore specials that ran in the 30s, and they're not connected.
All righty. Thanks so much for your call, Trevor. We're moving on here on the Talk of Gasoline Alley, live from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The historian, Donald Davidson, with us. Let's head out to Boston. Donald, Jake is on hold. Jake, go ahead. You're on the Talk of Gasoline Alley.
Hello, Jake.
Hey, guys. How you doing tonight?
Fine. Is that Boston, Massachusetts?
Yes, sir.
Good heavens. I don't think we get many from up that way.
Well, I've called every couple of years. So.
All right, then. Good.
I got a question. I wonder if you could profile Wally Dallenbach Sr., if that's all right.
Sure, yes. Wally Dallenbach was from East Brunswick, New Jersey, and then more recently Basalt, Colorado. I don't know if he's still there. And then there was another, was it Frying Pan Village or something is coming into my mind. But anyway, Wally was an East Coaster and actually got started in drag racing. And I'm going to jump around a little bit here because he's full of a few surprises. He drove sprints, midgets a little bit, but started with dragsters, as I said. And his debut in what I still call national championship racing was 1965 when he drove some races on pavement in a car that was called the Mel Nelson Special. And it was a lay-down roadster, which was happy to see. And the first time I saw Wally Dallenbach, he was wearing a red uniform, which was of the old type that was fire retardant, but it had been soaked in the solution to make it fire retardant. Anyway, here's a little trivia. Wally Dallenbach's first start in the 500 was 1967. And if one cares to compile a list of everybody who has driven in the Daytona 500 and the Indianapolis 500, that list is a lot longer than you would think that it was. And it's interesting, the number of people that you associate with Indianapolis that drove in the Daytona 500 before they drove in the 500. Dan Gurney is one, and Parnelli Jones is another, and there's several other surprises. And believe it or not, Wally Dallenbach drove in, I think it was 1962, was his Daytona 500 run. Anyway, became one of the most respected drivers, did not win the Indianapolis 500. He won the Ontario 500 in 1973. And in 75, but for a twist of fate, he would have won the Indianapolis 500. He led quite a distance and then broke down about the three-quarter distance. And I think within 15 minutes, it was raining. And that was the 75 race that was rain-shortened with Bobby Unser declared the winner, with Johnny Rutherford second and Foyt in third. Well, just a few minutes before that, Dallenbach had been leading, and you just think if he could have lasted, the ifs and buts of motor racing, if he could have lasted a little bit longer, all the rains had come 15 minutes earlier, and they couldn't get restarted, Wally Dallenbach would have been an Indianapolis 500 winner. Anyway, he retired in 1979. But was called to duty in 1981, by which time he had become the competition director for CART, which he did for many years, and was a very highly respected official. And there have been a number of drivers that were officials and a number of drivers that were excellent officials in various forms of the sport, including sprints, you know, dirt track, as well as championship competition. And probably the secret is that they've been there and they've done that. And so when somebody would come up and complaining about something, Wally Dallenbach was a very hard guy to BS because he had, you know, he'd been there. And I remember thinking, this is sort of one of my weird observations, and I think I've mentioned this a few times. There are several drivers over the years who have had a radio voice. And John Martin is one. A young Lee Koonsman had a radio voice. And I remember Wally Dallenbach, that when he would get up at the victory banquet to do his his brief few words after receiving the prize money. I remember thinking what a rich voice that he had, and very, very pleasing indeed. He could have done something with that if he wanted to. But anyway, as far as the 500 was concerned, he led the first couple of laps in 1974 and was a very early out. He was fourth in 76 and 77. And as I say, he won the Ontario 500, and in 1973 was second in the USAC National Championship. And so anyway, he's just had a very, very well-rounded career, and Hall of Fame material.
Jake out in Boston, give us a call again sometime. Thank you for calling in on the Talk of Gasoline. Allie, let's roll on. Let's go to Steve in Indy. Steve, try to call in last night. We'll get you in tonight. Steve, welcome to the program with Donald Davidson.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, guys. Hi,
Hello.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
I enjoyed your anecdote last night. My father actually worked for Clark Auto during the 50s.
And
worked
for
whom? Clark Auto Sales.
Oh, Clark Auto Sales. Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
it was 1948 that they sponsored the car, but I'm stepping on you. Forgive me.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear that. And in fact, I ended up working for Gould Batteries. I started there in 75, and I know they had sponsored Rick Mears, I think, later, maybe in 1980 or so. The
Gould Charge, yes. Well, in fact, when Mears won it in 79, it was the Gould Charge.
The Gould Charge, yes.
Yeah.
I was wondering, would it be possible, do you have any pictures of the Clark Auto at the museum, or is that something that's lost?
No. There's a shot. You would have to get it from the photo department, and I'm not sure that the shot... which I call a qual shot. They used to get all of the shots of the cars in practice, and for many years now, the standard has been that you make the qualifying run, and when you've completed the fourth lap and you come in, you go to the photo enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when Doc Williams in 1948, it might have been post-qualification, but I'm not sure that there was any signage on it yet, because a lot of those deals came together at the very last minute. I mean, this was going on for years. Now, still this last-minute sponsorship, but I remember actually being involved in a few of these, not as early as the Clark Auto special, but a car would qualify with no sponsorship on it, and then somebody would step forth and say, what would it take? Now, the Clark Auto Company sponsorship, and as I said either last night or in some previous evening, it was four used car lots in Indianapolis. That was probably $500 or something like that, because I remember that even in 78, 79, 80, I was working at the United States Auto Club, and the full month of May, 2 weekends of qualifying, and then when qualifying was over, it was several days until the race, and I would get calls on Monday after the qualifying was over by two or three different people that would say, we want to sponsor a car in the race. We've got some customers coming in, and we're looking here. There's seven or eight cars that don't have sponsors. Who would you recommend? And I said, well, you know, I'm not going to be a broker here, but I'll give you the names of the people that I think would want to do it. And a couple of deals were made for $2,500. And I remember that probably the last one I think I was involved in was in 1980, Bill Engelhart qualified for the Bedouin Brothers and was in the race, guaranteed, you know, sponsor the car and your name will get mentioned by Sid Collins on the radio network or whoever was the anchor at the time. And the Master Lock Company made a deal to get onto Engelhardt's car, and I think it was $5,000.
Wow.
Well, it's considerably more now. Mm-hmm. But anyway, back to your question. If you contact the photo department, and if you're not in a particular hurry, I would wait until the race is over and then maybe give them another week or so. But if you go up there and just ask for the qualifying shot of Doc Williams in 1948, but I rather think, because I think the car was entered, it was called the Ford Moyer Special, and then it became the Clark Auto Company Special for race day. So it's possible you'll be disappointed in that that name will not be on the side of the car.
Thanks so much for the call, Steve. In Indy, you can do it again tomorrow night as well. All right, we'll get to our final break of the night here on the Talk of Gasoline Alley with the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Museum, Donald Davidson. More to come live from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on FM 107.5 and 1070, The Fan. Welcome back, live from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley with the IMS historian, Donald Davidson. It's been a fun night so far. Let's continue it on, Donald, with Joe in Indianapolis. Joe, welcome to the program. You're on with Donald Davidson.
Hello. Hey, Tony, thanks. Hey, Donald, great show as always. I was wondering if you could spend a little bit of time and profile Dick Rathman tonight.
Oh, the other Rathman, Dick Rathman. All right. Yes, Dick was the as I'm sure a number of the listeners already know, Jim Rathman's name was not James. He was actually Royal Richard Rathman. And Dick Rathman's name is not Richard, it's James. He's the older brother by 2.5 years, and the story is that Jim Rathman wanted to start racing when he was like 16 years old, driving hot rods, and he borrowed his brother's identity, and so he was Jim Rathman, although Richard was his middle name, and Then Dick, as we know him, who was James, started racing a little bit later. And then, thank goodness, they never swapped identities back again, because it would have been very confusing. But anyway, Jim, as we know him, was first at the drove his first 549, and he was not yet 21. He and Troy Ruttman, who knew each other in school, both drove in the 49 500 at under 21 years of age. The following year was when, A.J. Watson had been involved on the Granker team in 48 and 49. In 1950, he came with a car that he entered himself and had built. Wasn't a roadster, it was a dirt track variety. And it was officially the City of Glendale Special, but it was nicknamed the Pots and Pans Special because a number of storekeepers and private entities in the City of Glendale put in, you know, like $25 and $50 to get the thing going. City of Glendale. Anyway, Dick Rathman was the driver. He only lasted 6 laps, and I think he ran at Milwaukee the next week, which was then dirt. And then he dropped out and went to NASCAR. He was an early standout in the very early days of NASCAR. So I think from 51 a little bit, but certainly 52, 53, 54, I think he was like third in points one year and fourth in another when they were all dirt tracks and running on half miles, and he had a Hudson Hornet, and NASCAR then was very, very different from what it became. Anyway, in 1956, Dick Rathman came back to Indianapolis after an absence of 6 years. He hadn't been there since 50, and then drove in the race off and on. I'll just do the summary and then go back and pick up a few details until it's time for us to stop. In 56, he drove, was entered for Lindsay Hopkins, but ended up driving for Lee Elkins in the McNamara Special and finished fifth. And they had to do a little bit of recheck of the scoring because in those days it was still where the winner would take the checker and then they would keep the cars going. It appeared that Dick Rathman spun and crashed going into turn one on his last lap. Well, it turns out that he'd already completed his last lap when they rechecked, so he ended up in fifth. In 57, he qualified a car, the Sumar Special, but was not able to drive on race day for reasons that we're not going to go into here. In 1958, he qualified for the pole. He was entered in the Chapman Special and got out of that when Lee Elkins, the McNamara man, purchased a brand new car from A.J. Watson that Watson had built during the winter. And Dick Rathman qualified for the pole. This was the year when, for about 5 or 6 days, it was back and forth and back and forth to see who would have the fastest practice lap of the day. His rival being Ed Elysian, the infamous Ed Elysian, who was driving for John Zink with A.J. Watson, and battling back and forth between the two cars were both built by Watson. John Zink wasn't very happy about that. In fact, that ended up with Watson leaving Zink during the summer. Anyway, Rathman set the four-lap track record, but Ed Elysian, whose run was just was a little more, I don't know if I'd say erratic, but it was up and down a little bit, he actually had the one-lap track record. Normally, the one- and four-lap track records are set by the same person. Anyway, not to drag this one out too much because it was pretty dramatic, but Rathman led at the start. It had been an aborted start. Ed Elysian caught him on the backstretch, and as they was going through turn three, Elysian lost control, probably because it's the first time all month that he'd run the full fuel load with 75 gallons, and Dick Rathman was unable to get around him, and they were collected, and both were involved in this horrendous accident that took the life of Pat O'Connor. Anyway, I probably spent too much time on that. In 1959, with the McNamara Chiropractic Special, Dick Rathman was actually running fourth late in the race when there was a pit fire, so he was out of that one. I'll hurry it along a little bit. In 1961, he was actually under contract for Jim Robbins, but he drove the Novi in practice for Granatelli and ran the second fastest practice laps, but Jim Robbins wouldn't release him to drive. Anyway, I'm going to have to hurry the thing up here a little bit. In 1963, he finished 10th, and in 64, which was his last 500, he drove a Watson Roadster and finished 7th. And it was notable because he wore a Cromwell helmet, a crushed paper helmet, painted yellow with all kinds of dings and bangs in it. And whether or not he thought he couldn't drive a rear-engine car or whatever, 64 in the Roadster was his last start. He had some really good runs in USAC stock cars, driving the Zico Lubade. In fact, there were several times at Milwaukee where Dick Rathman was right up in the top three in the stock cars there. Anyway, I think I've run us up against the wall here. So, Tony, back to you, and we'll see you tomorrow.
All righty. Thank you so much, Donald. We got into plenty tonight. The conversation continues tomorrow right here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan with another edition of the Talk of Gasoline Alley at 8 o'clock. We'll have you covered right here on The Fan all day for the third day of oval practice at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Don't forget you can follow along on Twitter at TonyD1070. Game one of the Eastern Conference Finals coming up right after this. You're listening to FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.